is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis. I welcome Anatole Levin, the Eurasia Project Director at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, writing most recently in respect to a proposal by a former General Secretary of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, published prominently on the front page of the Financial Times that I read, and recommending right now changes be made in assumptions about how to end the Ukraine conflict. The chief idea that comes up early on in the piece is a Eurocentric force guaranteeing security with an Article 5-like codicil that the countries participating in would all sign on to, that is, uniform defense. Anatole, a very good evening to you. You've written very poignantly that this is not an idea that will go forward. So then why is Mr. Rasmussen bringing that idea forward at this time? Who does it please? Who's his audience for a Eurocentric force?
Well, he was writing in advance of the meeting today in Paris of this so-called coalition of the willing to create or lay the basis for a reassurance force in Ukraine. So they were the people in the first instance he was trying to influence. Rasmussen also, one should note, is now an advisor to the Ukrainian government. So you also have to assume that he is, you know, reflecting Ukrainian views or wishes. There were some things in Rasmussen's proposal, which made me think that this can't be a serious proposal at all, because he, in terms of actually creating such a force, because amongst other things, he said that this force should be deployed to Ukraine not after a peace settlement, which is, or a ceasefire, which is what all the other leaders are talking about, but in advance of a ceasefire, in other words, while the war is still going on. Now, it's not just that, of course, at that point, Russia will never stop the war, but it's also that none of the European governments would agree to that, because you'd be putting their troops, you know, into the middle of a war zone where they would immediately start getting killed. For my own part, I have to say I am not sure that this entire idea is truly serious, because if you listen to what governments have actually been saying, you know, in the past, the talk was of a force, well, some people said 30,000, others said 50,000 to 100,000 would be needed. The British and French are obviously leading, because they are the only serious military powers in Europe, and the Germans have refused to take part, as have the Poles, by the way, despite the fact that, you know, Poland is supposed to be Ukraine's strongest supporter in Europe. If you read what British officials are actually now saying, they're saying that, Britain could provide air cover and battlefield surveillance and naval support. So there's nothing in these comments about ground troops at all. And there's good reason for that, because the former British Army Chief General Dannert said that in order to provide just one brigade permanently within Ukraine would, you know, if you count in leave and training and also, of course, having to keep some troops for other purposes, this would essentially take the whole of the British Army. And despite all these promises to increase British military spending, the British Army is still shrinking. More people have left the British Army this year than have joined it. The British Army is now, the entire army is less than 75,000 men. So, I mean, quite how, France, by the way, is in no better shape. So quite how these countries are actually going to come up with such a force is not clear to me. And I mean, if you look at the other countries which said they could participate, well, Spain has actually refused to meet the now the theoretical NATO target of 5% of GDP. Its military spending is the lowest in Europe, and yet it says that it would like to participate in this force. Well, you really have to begin to wonder whether, you know, much of this is really sincere or whether this is political grandstanding in the belief that it never will actually happen. But the problem, of course, and this may well be Rasmussen's intention, is that if they stick to this and are not willing to bargain it away in a deal with Russia in return for, you know, Russian concessions in other areas, well, there never will be a peace settlement. The war will simply go on. And, of course, then you have to look at the political state of Europe, not even in the long term. I mean, in France, in the very immediate term, and ask, you know, whether this is going to remain reliably behind Ukraine.
It occurred to me when reading the first time that when we came to America's participation, you mentioned air cover, air power, which is something Mr. Trump has already talked about. Is this document meant to charm the Trump administration to staying on board? Is that the concern they have at NATO?
Oh, absolutely. Well, charm, yes, in terms of saying we will do the heavy lifting, but also, of course, trap, because, you know, if America makes this commitment, then the feeling is that America is nailed to Ukraine and, by extension, in their view, to European defense and security. But this is a pretty risky strategy from two points of view. The first is, you know, there was a big clash this week between von der Leyen, the German president of the EU Commission, and Pistorius, the German defense minister, because von der Leyen said that the EU had drawn up clear plans for this European reassurance force and everything was going forward. And Pistorius, in a really unprecedented way, came out and said, sorry, this is not the business of the EU. You have no right to say this. You know, military deployments are a matter for national governments, and by implication, we're not going to do this. But the second thing is that von der Leyen said in an interview actually with the Financial Times also that Trump had given clear assurances of US air cover for this force. Well, if you read what Trump has been saying, he hasn't. He has said that the US could give certain kinds of support, including possibly air. He was much vaguer about this. And of course, as a former German diplomat, I know, said in a conversation, you know, do we really believe everything that Trump says one day, you know, when he may say something totally different tomorrow?
Then what we have here is no plan but lobbying. To what end? What do we believe Keith wants out of this? Rasmussen is a strong voice and he has lots of connections.
I think that Kiev is hoping that, and it's not a vain hope by any manner of means, that they can wear Russia down to the point where it abandons its the kind of demands that Ukraine cannot meet, or the government feels it cannot, you know, put to the Ukrainian parliament. Now, that includes, first, Ukrainian withdrawal from the rest of the Donbass that they still hold, which, you know, is several thousand square miles and 250,000 people. Now, there's no way that a Ukrainian government could agree to do that. The second thing is that Ukraine should actually sign a treaty of neutrality, you know, barring a treaty would have to go through the parliament, and that would create a monstrous political crisis. And I think you would also have, you know, huge demonstrations led by the extreme right. So, and, you know, perhaps also that you could, if you can wear the Russian army down, eventually Russia might agree, for example, that most of these seized assets in Russian assets in Europe would go to the reconstruction of Ukraine. That at least is what, I mean, there are hardliners in Ukraine who are still fantasizing about victory. But this is what I gather, you know, more moderate and sensible members of the Ukrainian establishment are hoping for, because they know now that they cannot, you know, defeat the Russian army and push it out of the territory that it occupies. But, you know, although Russia has been advancing more quickly recently, I mean, that is still glacial, you know, by the standards of most wars. It is taking them, well, it has taken them now more than a year to capture Pokrovsk, this small town in southern Donbass, and they haven't even captured it yet. I mean, they seem quite close to doing so, but at that point, you know, it would take them years to capture the rest, even just to capture the rest of the Donbass. So, and of course, amidst heavy casualties and economic strains. So the Ukrainians have a reasonable chance, as I say, of fighting a war of attrition that eventually, you know, compels the Russians not to surrender, of course, that's out of the question now, but to give up, you know, their impossible demands. But of course, it is also a risky strategy because, you know, the Ukrainians are outnumbered. Many stories about how exhausted their troops are. American supplies are limited and unreliable. And so I think this Ukrainian strategy could well work, but of course, it could fail, and the Russians could break through, at which point, well, I mean, then if that happened, then the Ukrainians, you know, might well regret that they didn't take an earlier offer.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Anatole mentions the three big parts of the EU, Berlin, Paris, and London. And there's a debt problem everywhere. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Baxter.